I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week are author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and author Arsalan Iftikhar, NPR's own political editor, our political junkie Ken Rudin, and from National Review Magazine and the Texas Public Policy Foundation, Mario Loyola. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey, I'm your papa.
I saw one of Diaz.
All righty then. Well, Iowa and New Hampshire, they're in the can, and Mitt Romney is 2-for-2. Now, next up for the GOP presidential primaries, South Carolina and Florida, which many political watchers say are do or die for some of these candidates, Michelle.
Go ahead, Ken. Well, Ken's going to tell us who's getting voted off the island next.
Yeah, our own political junkie. Who's next, man? Who's next to get voted off the island?
Well, I would kind of think that John Huntsman didn't really survive New Hampshire. He did say that, you know, it's a ticket to ride, but we don't care, as the Beatles would say. He spent all his money and time and effort in New Hampshire. He bypassed Iowa, thinking New Hampshire would give him new life. He tried to do what John McCain did by winning in New Hampshire and making a big deal for his candidacy. But 16% third-place finish, I think John Huntsman is really just going through the motions. The real story is Newt Gingrich, because right now it seems like the Republican Party for the longest time was finding it difficult to coalesce around anybody, let alone Mitt Romney, who may not have been sufficiently conservative. Now that he's won Iowa and New Hampshire, now that he has a lead in the polls, at least, in South Carolina and Florida, it may be a Mitt Romney nomination to lose, and that's not good enough for people like Newt Gingrich, who just feels that he had the nomination in his grasp until negative campaign ads destroyed him in Iowa.
You know what's so interesting, though, is how this whole question of the super PACs and the outside money, a money that can be funneled into campaigns, or we're not funneled into campaigns, but in support of candidates apart from the political parties, seems to be changing the game at this early stage.
That's the Supreme Court Citizens United decision that really changed everything and opened up money that we've never seen before in the campaign.
Well, and the reason why we're talking about this is that you talked about how Newt Gingrich is really the story here. The former House Speaker pledged to stay positive on the campaign trail, but after his weak showing in the Iowa caucuses, he blamed that on attack ads for distorting his record. Now he's got his own ads targeting Romney in South Carolina, which I understand are largely funded by one large donor. I'll just play a short clip. Here it is.
Romney opposed the contract with America, raised taxes, and authored government-mandated health care with taxpayer-funded abortions. But now, he tells us, trust me, I'm a conservative. Massachusetts moderate Mitt Romney, he'll say anything to win. Anything.
Wow.
What do you think about that, Jimmy?
Thanks. Well, you know, Michelle, according to the Washington Post yesterday, the GOP has gotten Newt again to pledge that he's going to play nice going forward. But you know what? For what? Politics, it's a dirty business. And I'm always amazed when these party people and career politicos, you know, they start to whine about attack ads and distortions from the competition. Oh, poor baby. But this is the way the game is played, right? This is what I'm thinking. And it's up to us, the electorate, to educate ourselves about who these people are and not rely on the competition to give us the skinny. Ken Dahl, Ken
Rudin. Let me just clarify one thing. Ad that we just heard was a Newt Gingrich ad that was not one of the super PAC ads. So if that was one of the staying positive ads, I just really can't wait to hear what one of the negative ones sound like.
Let's give him a chance going forward. Ken Rudin.
Let me just say one thing. And nowhere is politics played more dirty than in South Carolina. Remember eight years ago when John McCain was running, they talked about how he had a black baby out of wedlock, when, of course, the real story was that he and his wife adopted a baby from Bangladesh, and that was the whole story. But it's very dirty, very ugly, very critical in South Carolina. And Newt Gingrich, you know, his political power grew in this kind of politics. It may be his last stand, but he won't go quietly.
Super Mario, Mr. Loyola, your think tank receives funds from Texas Governor Rick Perry. Let's just get that right out front. But does he have a shot?
Book.
Okay, well, not from his pocket, but I'm just saying, does he have a shot?
I think his last stand is probably in South Carolina. So we'll see next Saturday. I think the race will be significantly clarified after that day.
Go ahead, Mario. I didn't want to hear from you, but I'm just curious why he's not doing better in South Carolina, because it would seem that he's a Southern governor. He does have a very consistent record as a conservative. You would think that he'd be doing better.
You know, the interesting thing about these primaries is I don't think we've ever seen the conservative movement so unified in what it wants and so at a loss to find the right spokesman for what it wants. And I think of all the candidates, of all the major candidates, the governor probably fits the bill better than any of the others, you know, fits the bill more exactly than any of the others, which is why he sort of catapulted to the top as soon as he announced. But he's got, unfortunately, as somebody said in Texas, he's not running for president of Texas. He connects well enough with people in Texas, but he doesn't connect with people outside of Texas. And in South Carolina, you know, they're Southerners and they're conservative. But I think by this point, that what's driving a lot of his low numbers, disappointing results in the polls is the fact that people don't think that he's electable. Yeah, people don't think he's going to be the candidate. People like a winner, and that's why they're gravitating towards Romney.
You're forgetting everything he did during the debates when he fell on his face. I mean, yes, he is a great campaigner. He's a great conservative, but he couldn't enunciate anything during the debates, and he fell on his face on that. And at the end of New Hampshire, and at the end of Iowa, when he says, I think I'm going to go home and reassess my candidacy, why would anybody put any money or confidence in a Perry candidacy if everybody thinks he's going to drop out anyway?
Right. Well, he went home and reassessed his. I think he went home and reassessed his bank account, which still had many millions of dollars in it.
Okay. Well,
but look, even think about it this way, though. Think about it this way. Even if he had done well in the debates, I think that his campaign still was going to face a major problem, which is that Rick Perry is the reality of the caricature that they tried to make of George Bush. I mean, this guy really is a cowboy, for real. And he really does have swagger, and he really does, you know, like to, you know, talk to, you know, his commercials are like, you know, him sitting on a crate in a barn.
And we all know how much swagger people sitting in crates and barns have.
Okay, well having said that,
that's cachet, that's chic in Texas.
All right, well, let's
give,
let's let Arsalan get in on this. Arsalan, I think that, okay, we can see that the Republican establishment, whatever that means, is coalescing around Mitt Romney. Like in South Carolina, for example, Nikki Haley, the governor, supported Romney for whatever that means. She has her own political problems.
Right.
But, and of course, Mitt Romney still has a lot of money. Isn't he the candidate, though, that the Obama administration is most worried about? Because he does offer the argument that he is the answer to the question that, let's just setting, you know, hardcore social conservatives aside,
right,
the question for most voters is the economy.
Right.
And doesn't he have the best argument of the field, which is that I have a proven track record of knowledge and experience in addressing economic questions, and therefore I am the man?
Well, I don't think that, you know, he might not have the best answers, but he certainly is the candidate that whose election this is to lose on the Republican side. I mean, basically, he needs to run out the clock now and make sure that nobody comes back and, you know, surprises him. I think what's interesting to note, first of all, on Newt Gingrich, you know, I don't trust him, you know, further than I could throw a baby blue Tiffany & Company box. But I think that what's interesting was NPR earlier reported that a lot of national evangelical leaders, including Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Convention and James Dobson, are meeting on a ranch in Texas to see if they can coalesce and get consensus behind one candidate. And I think that's what's interesting, is that for the first time in a very long time within the Republican Party, the evangelical thought leadership in America is not going to be playing kingmaker. And I think that that is an interesting trend.
I think
really that should be understood.
That's really interesting, but that's a nice way to not answer my question, which is that you are an Obama supporter, early supporter from Chicago.
Right.
Isn't Mitt Romney the person that they're really most concerned about? And isn't
clear?
Because he's going to, even let's say he puts South Carolina behind him, he's still got a lot of months to make his argument before November.
He does, but I think that, you know, obviously, you know, Obamacare is going to be one of the things that Republicans attack the most. But with Mitt Romney's own, you know, healthcare debacle in Massachusetts that almost mirrors Obamacare, I think that, you know, we'd like to take him on in the general election.
Ken has a final thought on this before we move on.
And that's why the Gingrich attacks on Romney's stewardship at Bain Capital is so devastating, because that is his weak link. You know, Obama's going to go after it in the fall. And for the Republicans to be going after it now is not exactly what the Republican Party needs to go into the general election.
If you're just tuning in, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're having our weekly visit to the barber shop with author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and author Arsalan Iftikhar, columnist Mario Loyola, and NPR's own political junkie, our political editor Ken Rudin. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, well, let's keep it in motion. Microsoft is talking about releasing this app they're calling the Avoid the Ghetto app. Essentially, it will tell users when they're headed into a sketchy neighborhood, Michelle. You know, I always rely on my in-laws for that. But
nice.
Now there'll be an app for that.
Your sketchy in-laws.
Let me just get
you in trouble.
Microsoft, you're already in trouble. But
right.
Microsoft does not call it the Avoid Ghetto app. They call the feature Pedestrian Route Production. And it's designed to help people get where they need to be with the least hassle, traffic, poor weather conditions. But it also is using crime statistics to direct users around potentially dangerous areas. But there are a lot of people who, it's interesting how this, like, there are literally hundreds of thousands of apps out there now. Mm-hmm. Are there? But it's so interesting how people immediately zeroed in on this to say, this is just reinforcing stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm interested in what people think about
this. You know
what,
Michelle? Can I just tell you? I think this is a great idea. I mean, you can't blame the application for the condition of a given neighborhood. Now, where I am concerned, it's for small business owners. Because, I mean, what will be the Google effects of this going forward? So if you're a business and you happen to be in one of these neighborhoods where the ghetto app says, you know, not so great a neighborhood, will your business not show up very high in the Google results? So, I mean, I think that's something to consider.
But beyond that,
I mean, when it comes out, I'm going to download it. I'm down with that. Super Mario.
Well, actually, Arsalan wants to weigh in because Chicago is his town, yes.
Well, okay, yeah, well, I mean, I think, again, what troubles me the most, and I think what troubles a lot of people, is how do you define crimes? You know, obviously, you're going to have sex offenders, you're going to have shoplifters, you're going to have domestic abusers in a lot of different neighborhoods that might be lily white and suburban and not, you know, fall under the auspices of this app. And so, essentially, I do have some trouble, you know, in the sense that all crimes occur in all neighborhoods. And so, how are you defining crimes? Is it, you know, just violent crimes? Is it crimes, you know, with weapons involved? I mean, I would say sex offenders and, you know, things like that are also crimes that should be of concern to people.
Well, but does shoplifting affect you?
Word.
If you're not just if you go into a store in a fancy neighborhood and that store happens to be one that shoplifters target, that has nothing to do with you, does it? I mean, what's the relevance to you?
Well,
good to know.
Well, but again, we're not told what standard they're using in terms of how you're defining crime. You know, crime is such a, you know, nebulous term, and it goes from nonviolent crimes to violent crimes, and it runs the gamut in terms of degrees. And so I think it is important to understand what Microsoft is trying to do in terms of defining crimes.
Mario, what do you want to say about that?
Well, I think Arsalan's just annoyed that Chicago is going to be like this huge, like, red avoid zone.
Texas, I love Chicago. Texas is a safe haven.
You wish Austin was so that you could get people out of your favorite restaurants. That's your problem. You know, we know what's going on.
No, you know that. You know, we sit on our front porches here and load up buckshot in our shot. You know, we take
shooting
stuff
from our front porch. Sitting your barns on crates and swag.
With your swagger.
Yeah.
Ken, would you use this?
Well, if I was going to a strange city that I didn't know, I'd like to know what's considered a safe neighborhood and not a safe neighborhood. But at the same time, I think of that 8-year-old Brooklyn boy, who that Orthodox kid who was coming home from day camp last summer, and in the safest neighborhood in Borough Park in Brooklyn, and he was attacked and dismembered by a member of the Orthodox community and the safest neighborhood in the world. So that's what made me what I thought of right away, because you can talk about dangerous neighborhoods and where it's not safe to work. You can walk in the safest neighborhood in the world and somebody can accost you and you'll never be heard from again. So, do I think it's a good idea? I think I'd like to know, if I'm a stranger to a city, what neighborhoods perhaps to avoid, or at least to be careful, keep my eyes open. But as Arsalan said, horrific crimes can happen anywhere.
So you can meet your bookie somewhere else, huh?
I do that on the fourth floor of NPR.
Okay. All right. Well,
of course, a particular crime can happen anywhere. But the main thing is we want to know what the statistics are. And for example, in Austin, the east side of Austin has a reputation of being very high crime. So I moved to the south side. Now, when I saw the crime statistics, I looked at my friend's house who lives on the east side, and there had been one break-in within 1,000 feet of her house in the last year. Where I moved, there have been 15 break-ins within 1,000 feet of my house. And I wish I had known that before I picked the south side over the east side. I mean, I love the south side, but my point being that these statistics are important. People should know them because naturally, as you know, once I saw that it had been 15 houses have been broken into within 1,000 feet of my house, I was like, oh, well, I'm going to be up sooner or later. And sure enough, last September, my house got broken into.
We're sorry.
Yeah, man.
You know
okay.
what?
They
we're going to get
TV
we're
going to
get
work anyway.
We're going to get Tim Tebow to pray for you. And
speaking of the Denver
Broncos, Tim Tebow voted America's favorite athlete in an ESPN poll. The poll position website found that 43% of the people who are aware of his success credit divine intervention. And so, of course, this is a way to lead us all to what we think is going to happen in the next round of the playoffs this weekend. So,
divine intervention is an interesting thing from the point of view of the people who think that Tom Brady is God, right?
So who do you like? What are you calling for the weekend, Mario?
I'm completely focused on the Packers, but I just think it was really funny. My friend from Boston posted this really funny picture that has Tim Tebow praying on the sideline saying, God, please help me get through the coming ordeal. And then there's a picture off to the side of Tom Brady saying, I'm sorry, my son, but I'm playing quarterback for the other team.
So you're focused on the... Okay. You're focused on the Packers. Okay. Arsalan.
Well, you know, Salon.com had an interesting column called What If Tim Tebow Were a Muslim? And, you know, had, you know, thanked Allah after every game or, you know, threw his hands up towards Mecca. Would America still love him? And I think that's an interesting question. I think the Patriots are going to spank the Broncos. I think that the Giants might have a chance in Green Bay. I think New Orleans and Baltimore are going to pull it out.
Okay. Ken?
Well, I'm a Giants fan, but the Giants are peaking at exactly the right time, but the Packers are just so deep and so good. I still think the Patriots win. I think the Ravens win, and I think the Saints beat the 49ers in San Francisco.
Yeah. Lots of cheering going on in the control room there. I don't know what that means. Jimmy, do you want to hazard your prediction?
Well, you know, insofar as I care, you know, I'm rocking with Tebow. I mean, but I'm really happy that this conversation has people talking about men in faith. And Jesus is all right with me, so rock on, brother.
Well, what about Arsalan's point? If he were a Muslim and
Muhammad is okay with me too. I mean, you know, so I mean, faith is what faith is. So I think the conversation is really important. So, but yeah, I think it's a good question.
Anybody else down with that? Anybody else like that? Mario, could you mind if I ask you? We only have a couple of minutes left. But what about Arsalan's point that if Tebow were a Muslim, would people still be cheering him on? What do you think?
Well, if Tebow were a Muslim in a Muslim country, I'm sure they would be cheering him on. But Tebow is a Christian in a Christian country, and people are cheering him on.
I think some people would dispute the fact that we're a Christian country.
Would you dispute
it?
Why don't
you just
dispute
Christian
it?
Country.
Some
well,
people
why
meaning
would you?
You, right?
It's like 90%
well, no,
Christian.
I mean, you know, in a treaty letter that George Washington wrote in 1789, Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1789, he said that we are not a Christian country. You know, our forefathers came here to escape religious persecution. Religious freedom is of sacrosanct. We have a separation of church and state, and that's what makes us not a Christian country.
Well, culturally, we're a Christian country. And I mean, the Thomas Jefferson thing, in those days, deism was very right. popular. And so they were like,
and the but,
one thing we can all agree, you know what? This is a football country. Jimmy Israel
right, exactly.
is, we worship football. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and author of the book, The Denzel Principle. He was with us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Mario Loyola is director of the Center for 10th Amendment Studies at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's a think tank focused on the impact of federal policy on states. Also believes in limited government. He's also a columnist for the conservative outlet, The National Review. He was with us from member station KUT in Austin. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, and he's also author of the book Islamic Pacifism, Global Muslims in the Post-Osama Era. And Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor, our political junkie. Ken and Arsalan were here with us in our D.C. studios. Thank you all so much.
Peace.
Go Yankees.
Yep, yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.